Good day, listeners. Jonathan Daugherty here with another edition of the Pure Sex Radio program. You know, we're a listener-supported outreach of Be Broken Ministries, and we exist to help individuals and families move from sexual brokenness to wholeness in Christ and equip others to do the same. On today's episode, Brian Ellsworth shares his personal story of trauma and addiction and recovery. Brian is the new executive director of Living Without Lust, which is a fellowship of men desiring to live with sexual integrity. Brian discusses his challenging past, sobriety-seeking turning points, and healing through an intensive program. He then shares how he went from a crippling addiction to now helping other men break free from unwanted sexual behaviors. The conversation stresses the significance of addressing underlying pain, seeking help, and the continuous process of recovery. To learn more about Brian and Living Without Lust, visit livingwithoutlust.com. For even more resources, visit BeBroken.org or check out links in today's show notes. And of course, friends, we'd love it if you would rate and review the podcast, as this really does help others to find it. Now let's dive into today's conversation with Brian. Well, all right, Brian Ellsworth, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, this is our take two. We attempted this last week, and you had, you know, tree limbs falling on your house, and yeah, we had tech difficulties, and it just obviously, I guess, wasn't the right time for us to try to get this done.
There was a my wife just texted. You know, I was talking about those dings. She said, "Hey, I just put my phone on do not disturb, so you don't get distracted with the noises." So that's funny.
Yeah. The irony is the text just distracted you, right? So,
well, I think more the ding. She knew the ding. Like, I'm a computer pro. I do have an iPad, but I've never navigated a laptop or a MacBook Pro. So,
yeah. Well, all right. Well, I was glad to have you on because we want our listeners to be able to just kind of hear your story and then what God's been doing in your life recently.
Yeah.
We love to highlight stories. And part of that is because I think people are fundamentally most impacted through story more than science and data and all these other things that are useful and good, but stories tend to move us the most. And so I wanted to have you on and be able to just share your story and then some of the things that you've learned along the way.
Sure. And, you know, I agree. I think as probably humans, but specifically as Christians, I mean, we are called to share our experience. And, you know, some of our experiences are messy, and the tendency is sometimes to avoid the messiness and only talk about the good things or frame it in such a way that we look positive. But the changes I've had in my life and the guys that have impacted change in my life are guys that were honest with their experiences in the murky seasons that allowed me to find my own hope, you know? And so I agree with you. I think our stories and experiences are very, very important. So with that, I mean, you want me to start with my story real fast and then you're the host, so you're greenlit to cut me off whenever, if I get into my textbook rambles. But yeah, I'm so Brian Ellsworth, 37, live in Memphis, be 38 in June. The product of, like many people, like trauma and dysfunction. I was raised by two parents who intended and did the best they could with what they had. And to kind of just fast forward to get me into adulthood, I was born in a little area of Memphis called Frazier, which at the time was a predominantly Black neighborhood. And I was, as you can tell, I'm Caucasian white male. I grew up in a neighborhood that I didn't really fit into, which ended up being part of my story, right? This lie that I don't fit in and I'm different than everybody else. But I grew up in this neighborhood, ended up moving for a plethora of reasons. But while I was there, when I was 8, I was sexually abused by a family member over the course of a summer. I had a guy that was who I looked at as my granddad. It was this will give you a little insight. My grandmother's third husband, who we called Poppy, was a casino dealer down at a casino in Mississippi about an hour away. And so my times with him as this like, oh, wow, this is what a real man's like kind of thing. He was a smoker and a card dealer, and he taught me how to shine shoes and shuffle cards. And do those kind of things. He tragically died of lung cancer when I was 9 or 10. And at the same time, my dad and my mom split up, divorced. My dad is was a well-intended guy, but just had his own demons and with all kinds of addictions, sexual drinking, those kind of things, and gambling. But my mom and dad split. My mom moved us to a neighborhood outside of Memphis at the time called Cordova. Now Memphis has taken over this little neighborhood, but Cordova at the time was predominantly upper middle class white. I call it redneck. Like the kids wore camo and they had ATVs and, you know, they had all these things. Well, I came from a predominantly urban neighborhood where we played basketball. So I got transplanted into this neighborhood that I just didn't fit into either. I looked the part, but we didn't have affluency. I'd never have shot a gun. You know, I just, there were certain things I never had done other than sports. And, my mom at that time was a staunch Southern Baptist lady. And, when she divorced my dad, though, she had plethoras of reasons and very good reasons. I think it did something to her. You know, I think it put her in her own trauma, and dealing with her own trauma. And she really worked that out, by being a workaholic. Now she was a single mom with a 11-year-old son, living in a house we couldn't afford. And, someone had passed away in her family. Her mom had passed away and left her some money so she could get this house. And so my whole middle school and high school life, my mom, for the most part, worked three jobs. I'd wake up, she was already at job number one, and I'd go to bed, and typically she was at job number three. And so I kind of got to raise myself. And, you know, therapeutically, they would call it the lost child as the middle child. I was an only child, but I was lost. Had a lot of independence, and I was a really good Eddie Haskeller, depending on people who listen to this age bracket, a gift to gab, a charmer, those kind of things. Could kind of always talk myself out of a mess, which was probably induced from just my dysfunctional trauma-based childhood. I wanted to survive, and I was good at reading who was someone I could maybe, who I considered safe or someone I could take advantage of or someone I could see as the bully. I've always had like a sixth sense for that. But, man, I got into this new neighborhood. I'm about 11, not fitting in. I'm a roly-poly. I'm like 4 foot nothing, round, buck teeth, bowl cut. And I just didn't fit in. And just the way happenstance happened, I was introduced to a friend, and he invited me to smoke marijuana. I'm in the summer in sixth grade, I guess. And so I smoked marijuana and drank beer for the first time. And I remember that moment. You know, I've been to a handful of rehabs, and they talk about in rehab sometimes, like, we have good forgetters as addicts. And, you know, you forget all the pain you cause, but you sometimes remember those good times. And I can still remember the euphoria of that. That really changed the way I felt, and it numbed a lot of pain. And basically from give or take 11 till I was 35, I've been sober a little over 2 years now. I have used actively something to numb how I feel, to evade talking about my feelings my entire life on a daily basis. And went from drugs and alcohol, marijuana and light beer, and fast forward into my later teens into scotch and doing other types of drugs. And I got to my adulthood and just fell into an industry where there's a lot of cash floating around. So I always had a little money in my pocket and was starting to get in trouble with, you know, pain pills and different kinds of drugs, gambling heavy, and then created that lifestyle led to, I think, you know, my sexual brokenness story. I've been with my wife for 15 years. We've been married since 2012. We started dating in 2009. But I had already had a lot of these sexual, you can call it sexual addiction or whatever it is, but I was living this quad lifestyle, which was drugs, alcohol, gambling, and sex. And I met my wife, who comes from her own dysfunction and trauma, where someone like me would be attractive to her, right? She had to come from something to find me attractive. And so she dealt with a lot of my indiscretions by denying them. Fast forward into 2016, and I'll kind of land my plane on my story and you can ask questions. But in 2016, I was out of town for a work trip and had a relationship that going on where I was talking to another woman. Long story short, this woman sent screenshots of what I sent to her, to this other lady who knew my wife. It was this crazy chain of events. So my wife is in Memphis. Our son at the time is maybe one. And she's getting these messages. I'm out of town for work and, that are pretty explicit, you know, and that was not the first discovery in our relationship on the sexual side. But that was one of the first times where it's like enough's enough. And, so I flew back to Memphis. I got counseling, got help, did enough to get out of trouble and hopefully get my wife back to feeling good and get back in her denial ways. Well, what my wife did from March of 2016 until today is she has progressively gotten better. She has really done the work and started with book studies and then therapy. She's done her own trauma work. And, from March of 2016 until December of 2021, when my sobriety truly started, I did multiple rehab stints. I did some IOPs. I've seen every CSAT in Memphis, just enough so I could pick apart why they're not good and I don't need to go see them anymore. And in the time of all that, my life really unraveled. The house of cards really came down with a lot of discoveries, a lot of poor decisions, a lot of bad financial decisions, a gambler's mindset almost, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And my wife constantly was doing work to better herself. And she got to a point where I would say by November of 2021, my wife knew 80% of our secrets or my secrets, which were a lot. And I had protected at all costs these final 20%. And, you know, I think how God works, you know, a power greater than myself and greater than her works is she was able to get into kind of this black book where she discovered every secret I had held. In a couple of different, she found basically a set of passwords and emails, logins to get into a bunch of different types of sites that involve women, involve gambling, all kinds of different things. And so she was totally exposed to the truth. And because of all the work she did, she finally said, I'm done. And that was on the heels. My dad, who left when I was 10, we rekindled a relationship when I was 18, had a very unhealthy codependent relationship. And so he was in my life. And what had turned out, my dad was the only guy that I kind of let a little bit of the truth out to. I'd get in some trouble with whether it was a gambling deal or a bad business deal or whatever. He was the guy that I could at least get something off my chest. Well, March of 2021, he died. And so I spent March of 2021 to December of 2021. And why I want to interject this just at the end here, it's what I've come to be one of the biggest reasons I was able to pause enough to find sobriety. When my dad died, I didn't have anybody to talk to that I trusted. And so I spent 9 months harboring all these secrets and all this dark stuff with nowhere to go. And I got heavily suicidal with a ton of suicidal ideation. It'd be better without me. She can take the insurance money. She's young. She'll find another husband. My kids will be better off without me. I got into that rabbit hole for months and I was depressed, but I didn't know how to get out. And so when my wife discovered this black box of secrets, obviously it was a devastating thing for her. It was a total relief moment for me. It was the first time where I could sit and breathe. I was in a ton of trouble. I'm trying not to cuss. That was my hope here on Be Broken today. But I knew I was in a ton of trouble. I didn't think I would be able to talk my way out of it. I felt totally exposed and caught, but it was like this moment of relief and I could breathe. And so when that was on December 27th, very, very early on the 27th. So put that into effect. That's a day and a half after Christmas, which is not great either, right? Because my actions with the lie is you're only hurting yourself, but I've hurt Christmas in our household for now, you know. Christmas is not a joyous time. But all I'd say, I got sober December of 2021. And I'll speed this little part up. The way God works, I had one guy that I knew that was active in AA that I believed was true. Like, I knew people that were in AA or said they did recovery. I didn't believe they actually did that stuff. I thought they just lied like I did. But this guy, I called him. I called a therapist guy. And from there, it started to unravel in a good way. There was three different people in organic ways told me I needed to go to this place in Boulder, Colorado, called Begin Again Institute. Also has a second, it's a Begin Again Institute and Boulder Recovery. I was able to get into Boulder Recovery, and I called those guys right around the new year, about 3 days sober. Got them on the phone. They said, look, in order to take you, you got to be 30 days sober. There's a thing that starts in 26 days. If you can make it 26 days, you can come. And that was probably the hardest 26 days of my life, just to be totally transparent. At that time, I'm in a separation with my wife. There's no real hope there. I'm not really sure how to talk about my feelings. And this thing and these crutches I'd used for 24 years up to that point are now, I can't do them. And I just remember that was the hardest part. And I got to that point, I flew to Denver, got picked up, we drove to Boulder, and, man, I found a ton of hope, freedom, whatever the cliche word you want to use, by going to this place in Boulder. And, for the first time was given words. I'm sure I was given words before, but for the first time where I could hear it, I was given words, that really helped me talk about my feelings. I'm still learning those words. I'm not a pro by any means, you know, but it gave me some hope. So I got back to Memphis, man, and at that time, roughly February of 22, and just kind of hit the ground running, working some 12-step programs, helping guys at my church. And then fast forward, well, I was going to tell you about how I met Jay and got to Living Without Lust, but we can talk about that in a minute. But that's kind of the quick of my 37 years on this world.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. You know, yeah, I've got a couple of questions that I want to ask. One is, you know, you talked early on in your life where you had some maybe skewed views of what maybe manhood really was to look like from your dad, from your poppy, talk a little bit about how your view of what it means to be a man was shaped in your childhood, and maybe where you have started to discover afresh, what does it truly mean to be a man?
Yeah. I haven't really figured that out yet. The back half of that question, to be honest, I do know this, I seek out guys in my life now, and I've done this my whole life, really. It's kind of interesting. I've always had this dad wound where I want this older guy in my life. But in my unsober life, I was seeking out guys who are movers and shakers, making business deals, a little gray, a little rough around the edges. Now that I've gotten sober, you know, I'm looking for guys like my sponsor in my life through my 12-step work. You know, he's a guy that I'll call him. I say, what are you doing? He said, I'm washing the dishes. And I think, oh, my gosh, that's a great idea. I should wash the dishes at my house. And I know you like laugh, but it's like I've now gotten myself around guys who do, quote unquote, the right thing. And I see that. And it's like, OK, well, if he can do the right thing, how did he get there? So I'm seeking out guys. But as far as my skew of manhood, I told you about Poppy. His name was Joe Glisson. Badass Korean War vet, just tough as nails dude. But the sad part of this was his wife and his first family lived across the bridge from Memphis and West Memphis. And he was living with my grandmother. He was a gambler. He was, you know, he had that edge to him, but he was a guy that was dependable and woke up and did the right things, in my opinion, as a 7, 8, 9-year-old kid. Fast forward, one of my favorite people in the whole wide world who I love to death, who's my uncle. I mean, just a great dude. He is able to do what I can never do with drinking. He's a guy, he's scotch on the rocks all day and is functioning and doing stuff. He's got the big green egg and he's grilling, he's making steaks, right? So when I got into my middle school and high school life, that uncle was like, okay, that's who I need to be like. You know, and so I had what I thought were these things I needed, but I just didn't know what I didn't need at that time. And, Manhood for me is trying to be consistent today, right? It's trying to be consistent, be reliable, show up, and try to serve my family in that way. And what's on the back burner now is making deals. Like, obviously, I'm an entrepreneur. We haven't talked about this. Entrepreneurial background. I'm not really politically correct in some regards to be a 9-to-5 employee. So I've always kind of had a hustle, been a co-partner with someone. And today it's less about stroking a deal to make some money so I can finance bad habits, but it's more, I got to obviously pay our bills and do those things, but I also want to be reliable to my kids, but they're having to live with, I'm only 2 years in, right? So I'm not where I want to be by any stretch of the imagination. And they would say I'm not there. You know, I think they would say I'm way better and all that, but I still have my hard edges where I'm learning. I'll give you a small example. We do movie nights on Friday nights now. My kids are 9 and 7, or my son will be 9 in a few days and my daughter's 7. But, you know, they'll say, hey, Dad, pick a Disney movie for tonight. I don't have Disney movies. You know, I didn't watch movies as a kid. I just had a different childhood. So a lot of it is learning to be a kid as well. Even though I am emotionally stunted as a kid, it's learning to navigate that and like, hey, it's okay to sit and watch a movie for 2 hours. Some other things, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously there's been a lot of pain and trauma in your history. As you mentioned, you know, you're relatively early into this recovery season. I'm very familiar with what, you know, Boulder Recovery does in terms of their intensives, which they're going to tap in to all of that pain, all of that trauma, deal with the emotional elements. What has that part of the journey been like for you? And what I mean, I guess the way I want to frame up my question is a lot of guys that say, hey, I know I've kind of had an awakening where I know I need to get sober. A lot of times that's so focused on the behavioral modification. Like I need to stop doing these negative behaviors.
Right.
That when a therapist or an intensive or whatever says, guess what? We're going to have to uncover and unpack all of this history. A lot of guys run for the hills because they said that's not what I signed up for. I just want to never go back to these behaviors. So what has that part of the journey been like for you to say, I can't ignore the trauma, the pain, the wounds that I've got to deal with?
Yeah, I think for a long time, right, I talked about my wife getting her help, you know, so there was some behavior modification that I was trying to practice to stay married. So some of these guys I can empathize that are in that behavior modification. I think I lived in that world, though I wasn't wholeheartedly wanting to be sober. I wanted to be better. I wanted to take, you know, rein it in a little bit. And so I can empathize with that. For me, what happened was, you know, every addict has an enabler or two. You know, these people that kind of just keep writing blank checks, co-signing what they're doing, even though they say and they're doing it out of love. And for me, I've found personally and guys around me that are truly sober past this behavior modification piece is the enablers have stood their ground. And for me, I had that, right? My dad was one of my main enablers. He died. So that fixed that. And secondarily, my wife got the courage to leave me. And because of that, when I got to Boulder, I knew it was way past, I got to modify these behaviors. It became something where it's like, I got to figure this out. Now I'll say this, where I'm at today, man, I'm struggling, in some regards, cause as you start digging into that pain in the past, it's like an onion. You just keep peeling more and then you remember stuff. I just spoke at my aunt's second 10-year AA birthday. This is like 3 weeks ago. You know, her son, who was my cousin and I grew up, were 2 months apart. Thick as thieves, born the same year. He tragically died of an overdose when we were 21. And, you know, this is a small example, but as I've unearthed being able to start digging into some feelings and emotions and memories, I'm starting to remember stuff that I, you know, suppressed for a long time. And so the struggle today is to want to keep digging And, you know, my wife and I, we do these kind of date nights and sort of quasi business meetings, she calls them. And, you know, I'm having some church wounding I'm really dealing with and church hurt that's been suppressed. Also, as I'm digging through these feelings that are going on, you know, that's the first nature, which is a void. That was my first nature for so long. You know, it's like, I've really got to force myself to dig deeper into these things. Cause I realize if I don't keep digging into those to get all the way to the root, you know, I'll never truly find, you know, whole freedom if you may. And so I think it's just a progressive battle, and some days are discouraging and some are like, all right, I gotta stay the course. I gotta dig in here. I don't know if that made sense, but
yeah. And well, go ahead and tell us kind of the rest of the story in terms of how you got connected with Living Without Lust and just kind of what you're doing now, even in the space of ministry.
Yeah. So Jay Haig, who runs Living Without Lust, founded it. Great dude. And you, I think y'all know each other through SEALs and some other stuff. Just back to me being sober, trying to find these guys who've done it the right way. Right. He's one of those. So we got connected through Matt Wanger, who's the clinical director at Begin Again. Matt and I stayed friends. I've been fortunate to be able to send a handful of guys to Boulder since I've gotten out, and I made friends with Matt, made friends with a guy named Tom Ryan, who's a part of Boulder Recovery's model out there. But Matt, Jay was looking for someone to maybe pass the baton to, and Matt suggested me, which I thought was a huge vote of confidence. And so Jay and I started hanging out. He said, would you be interested in this? I said, probably not, but I want to be your friend. And so that's how it started. And, you know, when you get to the brass tacks, it's a small stipend. We're not a highly funded ministry. And that's a little bit by design. You know, one pitch I'll ask, you know, here in a little bit, like if people want to donate to us, they can. What I really want to drum up is a slush fund to help some of these guys get to rehab that can't afford it or get to places that don't accept insurance. But we'll talk about that later. But with Jay, he called me. I said, man, I'm probably not interested in that, but I'd love to kind of know you and be your friend. And that started. And then I realized, hey, this is really not a full-time job as far as pay. And I thought, okay, that's kind of been my MO for a long time. I got a lot of jobs that don't really pay me anything. And, why I'm wired that way, I'm not really sure, but, I'm a believer in biovocational ministry. You know, some of my struggles with church is, you know, we pay these people a bunch of money. We fund these big, beautiful churches. Like, man, could that money go other places? I don't know. I know this isn't the time to open that can of worms, but when I realized, hey, this isn't really a money grab, this isn't a full-time job for me as far as pay is concerned, it's a small stipend. There were some things that most people would run away from. I was like, oh, okay, I like that. And then I realized really what Jay was doing and what Jay in Living Without Lust was doing mimicked what I was doing in my personal life, which was simply just knowing resources to provide for guys who are in trouble and need hope. And, so I put Jay and I started changing, you know, sharing Rolodexes, and we knew some of the same people. There's people he knew. I was like, man, I'd love to know that guy. There's guys I knew he wanted to know. And so I really saw some synergy with Jay and with what they're doing, right? At the end of the day, what Living Without Lust was and still will be is simply to be a bridge with guys on the front lines, whether that's pastors, men's ministry leaders, whatever it may be, guys that have men coming to them that are broken and need help, but they themselves might not have the experience that Jay or myself have had, right? These are kind of the quote unquote good guys that hadn't blown up their lives to have to get help, where we can then be a bridge and say, no, we need to get you, you know, to this place, or we really need, yeah, give that guy my number. And so on a daily basis, I get to talk to other guys who need to find resources and help. And it's a beautiful thing, man. So the goal for Living Without Lust moving forward is to stay in that capacity, know what's going on around us ministry-wise, especially in the sexually broken world. With my background of more process addiction, obviously sexual addiction is a big piece of it. I give a little different color to my story than Jay does because I have a few more you know, addictions than Jay did. And, So I think it's really navigating how can we get to guys too, and maybe who are struggling with alcoholism, struggling with drug addiction, struggling with gambling, some of those things. That's kind of the next frontier, I would say, that we're looking at. And Jay and them had a conference they were doing every year in Jacksonville. We will keep doing that. I won't name drop anybody here, but there's some other ministry leaders who are doing conferences who I've gotten to talk with. Being in my adult life, I've been an event promoter. And so with my background, I have a weird set of knowledge that I think Living Without Lust will be able to tie in with some other guys and help put on some conventions, some conferences, things of that nature. So that's the other thing we're kind of looking at.
Yeah. Well, as we kind of wrap up here, I want you to talk to that guy out there that is either like he's still in the dark or he hasn't shared his full story. You talk about, you know, the 80%, you know, kind of thing, or that guy that is feeling like he's stuck, like he's hit a plateau or he's hit a ceiling or he's just like, man, I'm really stuck. What kind of encouragement, just kind of based on your own story and the journey that you're on, would you want to give to that guy out there that's in that kind of situation?
Yeah, I'll say this. I do truthfully believe I'm not an advice giving guy. And so I will say I'll give my experience around it and what my hope is for myself and for that, I guess, in turn, that person, you know, is really for that guy that's not fully exposed like myself. The hope is, man, I hope you get fully exposed. I don't think there's a way for you to get the help you need until you have gotten to your bottom. But the flip side to that is your bottom could be today. I mean, you could quit digging right now and essentially just start asking for help. That is just such a hard thing when someone is close to being caught, but not all the way there, man, that subconscious, that shame, the guilt controls them so heavily that it's hard to make that step. In Memphis, we have an interstate system called Interstate 240. It's a loop around Memphis. And how I talk about my recovery journey, man, I'm in the far right lane of Interstate 240. I want to get out of the addictive life so bad. I know it consciously, but I just couldn't. I just couldn't veer off to get off at that exit and get off the rat race. And so for me, the experience was I had to be fully exposed. But I do think there's a side of this coin for some of these guys, understanding you don't have to keep digging the hole you're digging. And the hope would be that something happens, something triggers enough. I think for me, I got tired enough that I let myself get caught subconsciously. My subconscious finally said, we've had enough. I'd done the same process and practice of hiding my secrets every day for 10 plus years, every day before I went to bed. I had the same routine to hide all my stuff before I went to bed. And I just got out of that habit, man. And I think God, you know, power greater than me, whatever you want to call it, subconscious, was as tired as I was and allowed me off. The second person you had asked, who was that again?
That's the guy that feels stuck.
I would just say where I'm at today is I have parts of me that are very stuck. And my natural tendency is to regress, go hide. I'm great at hiding. I could be in a room of 1,000 people, but I'm totally isolated and I'm great at that. I'm the guy that loves to host parties and I'm going to man the grill. I'm going to clean up the dishes afterwards, right? Like I want to be a part of it, but I don't want anybody to know me. And so for the guy that's stuck like me, man, hopefully they have some group of guys, a recovery ministry they're in, a 12-step group they're in, to just say that. You know, I've got a group of guys, if I'm really struggling and I say, boom, I'm struggling, it is like the fast pass. You're given permission to start asking questions. But I've got to do that. You know, these guys aren't going to do it for me. And so for the guy that's stuck, just encourage them and pick up the phone. I know that's the hardest part, and call somebody. If you don't have a sponsor or anything like that, go find a guy that's a little ahead of you and just say, hey, man, here's where I'm at. And the craziest part of it is everyone you go talk to that's a little ahead of you has been right where you're at. Mm-hmm. Tragic part is this. The ones that don't get the courage to truly ask for help when they're stuck, they usually don't come back and they don't make it. And I think the biggest blessing I have from going to daily recovery meetings, I don't go every day these days, I at least go 5 days a week, is I get to still see people in a lot of pain who are either new coming in or have totally gotten off the path and have totally ruined it even worse. And though you don't want to see any of that, it's great for my recovery. But the only way that I can see it is I'm showing up to meetings, even when I don't want to, and calling people when I don't want to. And so the encouragement, man, is just do it. And just realize there's help on the other side. But at the end of the day, we got to do this. You know, we can't play the victim. We can't wait for it to be done for us. We've got to make some moves. And then you realize real quick, when you make those moves, I call them God wings. I call guys all the time who I've avoided calling or whatever. And they're like, dude, I was about to call you. Or I'll say something and it's like, oh my gosh, you got to meet this guy. And then it opens this whole thing. People have different terms, but God has these things set up for us. But there is some action that we get to play a part in, you know? And so the encouragement, man, is just to follow through and pick up the, you know, the 10,000 pound phone and call somebody, text somebody, and be vulnerable.
Yeah. Well, Brian, this has been a great conversation. Where can guys go to learn more about what y'all are doing?
Yeah. So livingwithoutlust.com is the website. Like I said, we are, if there's somebody out there that wants to help support us, we don't necessarily need support to pay me. But I really am trying to come up with some support. There's guys out there that I want to get to Boulder and some other places, and those guys in those places will work with me. But at the same time, I'd love to create a slush fund to be able to help some of these guys get where they're at and also help their spouses, the betrayed partner, get to a place they can go get help. And so, and I'll just say this, you can link it or whatever. I'm happy to give my email and my cell phone. Is that, will you put something in a bio, or I can just say it?
Yeah. We can put stuff into show notes.
So in show notes, you know, I'll have my cell phone on there, text, call anytime. And if you got a friend struggling that just needs help or something, please send them our way. We'd love to just, there is no fee to what we do, right? It's just, we want to help someone get to that right person so they can go on their journey and hopefully share the message and their hope down the line.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being with us, Brian.
Yeah, man, I appreciate it. Hope to see you again soon. I'll hopefully see you at SEALS in May, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and listeners and viewers, we're going to put a lot of info in the show notes to help you take your next best step toward wholeness in Christ. And we're always glad that you're with us, and we look forward to seeing you back here again next time on the Pure Sex Radio program. Take care.